the overwrapping thesis for me is that I believe that qualitative research is going to grow much faster than quantitative research over the next 10 years. And the reason I believe that is, at the end of the day, a survey is just trying to facilitate a conversation at scale, but nobody speaks in Likert scales. Nobody speaks like in pick lists. And so the ability to be able to analyze 1,000 people's points of view, have a conversation with 1,000 people in a qualitative framework is very, very intriguing, very powerful, because it allows you to really uncover the true, connect with humans in a human way.
Now, if you've ever worked with a survey, attended a focus group, watched a video interview with a customer, or possibly even thought there must be a better way to teach your kids maths, then you've probably worked with some of the companies Jim in Brazil has set up, managed and introduced to businesses across the world, including 75% of the Fortune 500. Jamin was the co-founder and CEO of Decipher, the CEO of ConfirmIt, the founder and exec chairman of HubUX, which was sold to VoxPopMe, where Jamin is now the chief revenue officer. He's also an academic, a philanthropist, a very good podcast host, and a lovely guy to boot. To that end, if you keep listening, you'll also discover why Bluey the cartoon is key to a happy life. I'd also like to take a moment to say thank you to Brighter for sponsoring this episode. Brighter is an international research and insights consultancy specializing in healthcare technology, telecommunications, and gaming. You'll find out more at brighter-global.com. That's Brighter with a Y. So B-R-Y-T-E-R, then global.com. Now, onto the interview. So, Jim, first up, thanks so much for joining today.
It's an honor to be part. I'll tell you something that I learned about 10 years ago when I started this journey of podcasting and speaking, and that is never miss an opportunity. And so for me, I'm very thankful and grateful for any opportunity to join a podcast or a conversation with another research professional. So thank you, Henry.
Well, thank you. That's very kind. Firstly, to be described as a professional, which many people have been slightly dubious about. And also, you are actually truly the podcast master, but we'll probably get on to that actually during the course of the interview. So, Jim, one thing I just wanted to start off with, I ask most of the guests this question. What's something about you that most people might find surprising that they wouldn't find just as part of your standard online profile?
COVID was an interesting point for me, going from traveling 80% of my time to not traveling at all. So they had a tremendous amount of free time, put that in air quotes. And so I picked up a hobby, woodworking, and I make furniture, cabinetry, whatever, started with cutting boards, and have found, in fact, even for our employee appreciation things that I do now, I'll oftentimes make them some sort of like a cutting board or whatever, in the form of reward. And I just find it so satisfying actually building something with your hands.
That is so cool. I love that idea of actually making something for employees as well. It actually shows you care, like you've put the time into it.
And I'll tell you this, like what connected to that, I've oftentimes, because it's easy to write a check, and I'm not demeaning the importance of the money either. But if you play the long game with relationships, which you and I both do, you have to understand that in 10 years, that person's probably not going to be connected to you. That you're appreciating at that moment in time. However, if you give them something that's connected in some way, whether it's an award that sits on a desk or framed or whatever, they will always make that connection to that time in their life when they were appreciated. And the value there is you're giving them something that's actually got ongoing attribution of making them feel valued. And I think in today's economy, that is absolutely priceless.
Yeah, I definitely agree. It's a big subject in itself, isn't it? But yeah, I mean, I suppose in comparison, because I still have some of those, and I'm very grateful for those processes, but I have some of those kind of corporate finance transaction, like tombstone type things.
Yeah, yeah, tombstones, exactly.
That's... Yeah, but they're sitting around in my office, but I know they give them to everybody. And, you know, they're just mass manufactured somewhere. So it doesn't really mean quite as much as if you're someone had carved it themselves, which is probably asking a little bit too much for them to do that type of thing.
Yeah, I mean, point taken. This is a really interesting point that you're making. And that is, there's very little in today's world that anchors us to the past. And I'm thinking about you know, our digital personas and the way that we have been reframed in the context of stories, right? Where you have or feeds, and everything is quite literally real time. So if you and I followed each other on Instagram, I'm not very active there, but if we did, presumably we would use Instagram stories, and I would see these snippets of you in that point in time, right? In time. And then those would go away, and then you would provide more information, Snapchat, et cetera. And so having something that is actually tangible, whether it is the tombstone that memorializes some, you know, PE transaction or whatever, or a cutting board that was made by your boss, you know, those things, I believe, are where management should be trying to over-index. And the reason why is again, the attribution of, hey, I remember when, and it just continues to pull you back to that point in time. We had it before with the, in our generation, I'm not presuming that you're as old as I am, but I'm 53. And I grew up with a photo album that was, you know, my mom would update it every year with a couple of pages of like key photos from that year. And it would just sit out on her countertop growing up. And so it was always this like opportunity to be able to, you know, thumb through that at, you know, whatever, some random points during the month. And, you know, that's just, those kinds of things just exist less and less in our society.
Yeah, it's so interesting you say that, because I was thinking exactly that when you were talking about the example of Instagram. And, you know, it is very ephemeral, not particularly Instagram, but just digital media as a whole. And I was thinking of exactly the photo album thing. And I was actually wondering if that might come back to that point, because I noticed in actually one of my kids' rooms today, who's 15, he's got up old school photos, you know, kind of amongst album covers and whatever. From like when they were like six or seven. So, yeah, interesting about having that tangible, physical kind of point of connection. But Jamie, I probably should wrestle us back onto the onto the topic of the podcast and your career and where the industry is going as a whole. So could you just talk me through a little bit through your career? You've had an amazing career. I mean, starting off with, you know, Decipher and then Focus Vision, and their companies I know quite well because I was a client of them. But what did they do? Why did you set them up? You know, how did the proposition evolve?
Yeah, I mean, for me, there's a rule. And when I started Decipher with Jamie Plunkett, neither of us were smart enough, even though he did graduate from Stanford, to kind of frame things out as we do today. But really, there's four key questions. And that is, you know, is there pain? And so thinking about like Decipher, which is a premier professional grade survey platform, for those that don't know, and then later Focus Vision, which was the leading and market dominant video streaming service for focus groups and IDIs. You know, both of those businesses, there was pain, right? So with Decipher, this is pre-adoption of online surveys. You know, we were doing pencil and paper intercepts and phone-based intercepts, very clunky, very time-consuming, very expensive. A lot of pain there. And then the question after that really becomes, you know, does the consumer know there's pain? And again, in both cases, there definitely was pain. So if you're a researcher at Procter & Gamble, you might not be able to travel to all the different global focus groups, in which case with Focus Vision, you could then just sit down at the comfort of your computer and watch those in real time. And then, you know, is the customer willing to pay to have the pain removed, or are they willing to buy the solution? Is the third question. The fourth question is, are they willing to buy it from you? And that fourth question is really, really, really important, and one that I had not really ever over-indexed on. I just asserted that if you can answer the first three, then obviously the fourth is true. And with my most recent startup that I had, HubUX, that sold to BoxPopMe, you know, that was a big learning for me, because I realized, even despite the fact that I had lots of relationships and a solid brand, you know, walking into 2000 and into COVID, basically, with corporate budgets and, you know, changing, et cetera, there's a lot less appetite for new tech in the space. And so it created a lot more challenges for the business, even though I was checking off the first three.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. I hadn't thought about it quite like that. I probably should have done. I mean, the first part is the classic VC type of thing, isn't there? You know, is there a market problem? Is there a market opportunity? But then the next two and three. So what would two and three again?
Yeah. So are they, is there pain? And then do they know there's pain? This is a really important part that oftentimes is skipped, especially in the VC framework, because it's so obvious from an outsider. It's like, of course you'd want this. You want this problem to go away. But the reality is that the market's like, no, I don't have the visibility that this is an issue at the moment, in which case now you're on an educational path. And so a good example of this right now is generative AI. So, you know, with the launch of ChatGPT in November 2022 with OpenAI, you know, there was this brand new fancy tool, okay? And it does a bunch of stuff. And it actually makes people's, has the opportunity to improve our lives, right? As researchers, I mean, more specifically. But the problem, right, is that, like, does the consumer, in this case, the market researcher, does the market researcher actually recognize that doing something like creating a discussion guide is painful? Like, is there, you know what I mean? And so now all of a sudden you might have to go on this process of this campaign on, hey, old school discussion guides suck. Don't do it that way. You start with ChatGPT as the, you see what I mean? So there's like an educational component, which is not where you ever want to be if you're starting a business, because there's too much time and money spent in that phase of education.
Yes, yeah, so thanks, Jamin. It's really interesting. And I would definitely like to go back to your points on AI in a moment. So summarizing, if I'm getting it right, number one, is there a problem? Number two, do your potential customers know that there's pain? Three, are they willing to pay? And then four, are they willing to actually pay for it or buy it from you? So does that interrelate, or how does it fit in terms of some of the businesses I've been involved with recently? We found it a lot easier if you're trying to take market share rather than create market share. So does that sort of fit into that rubric in some way? How should companies think about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you've checked those first four boxes, then it's a function of how does a customer pay? A lot of times there's two components of this, and then I'll talk about the actual dollars. The first component is you need to make sure it's insanely simple for the customer to buy from you. And it sounds so intuitive, and everybody's like, "Oh, it's absolutely the case." But if your customer is not accustomed to buying SaaS, and they only buy ad hoc, then you better figure out how to change your terms of trade to align with ad hoc transactions, or you're going to have an uphill battle. It's very, very hard to convert those customers. It's doable. I've done it, but it takes years and is a 10x decrease in the amount of money that you'll wind up unlocking over those years initially. The second part of it is where the customers, like how the customer pays for it. They already have an allocated budget, right? So let's assume that they're on a normal calendar budget. Their budget starts in January, ends in December on December 31st on a calendar year. They might have, let's say, $1 million set aside, of which a portion is for software and another portion for services or whatever, right? However their distribution is. And they have allocated that budget because of the way that they've been paying for things to solve their problems, to get their work done in the past. If you're a new offering and you come in, you're like, gosh, we need a new dollar, meaning that they don't have a budget line item that you're immediately addressing. So you're additive to the budget. It's very, very hard for them to go back to budget stakeholders and say, listen, I know I said a million, but I need $1.1 million or I need $1.2 million in order to pay for this new fancy thing that's going to have some attributable value to my business. I can get stuff done better, faster, cheaper, what have you. It's much easier if you're able to take that $100,000 or that $200,000 that they're spending with an existing provider or an existing software solution and remove that incumbent. And I'm going to give you a specific case study here from a SaaS perspective. So Decipher, which is a survey platform, my nemesis back in the day was Confirma, and another company called Dimensions, which nobody can remember. But anyway, so that was the three-legged stool. If you're a professional market researcher, you're probably using one of those three. Qualtrics really wasn't in the mix in those days. And so what wound up happening is a company like Infirmit, they would lock a customer into a 12 or 24 month contract, right? On this is a per complete basis. So they might do something like they would sell something like to eBay. eBay would have a $100,000 annual contract for the software, and then eBay would pay them another $500,000 for completes on top of that. Okay, but the $500,000 would be on a per project basis as opposed to built into the SaaS $100,000 contract. That makes sense so far?
Yeah, it does. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, great. And so you've got this like framework that eBay is already accustomed to. So what I did with Decipher, I could go in and say, listen, I'm going to compete with for that same $600,000. And I can do a better, faster, cheaper job. Instead of you paying $100,000, I'm only going to charge you $50,000 for the software. I already lose because now they've got $150,000 that they've got to assign for this single budget line item. And they can't justify it to stakeholders because it means that, you know, they lose credibility because stakeholders are like, why in the hell are you shifting? You should have had that decision much longer ago. And so it would protract the contract, the negotiations until the Confirmit license was up for renewal, right? So what I did was I said, listen, I'm going to give you my platform for free. Let's say that they had signed up for 1 million completes for Confirmit, whatever the number is. I'd say, I'm going to give you a free license. I still need you to sign a contract up to that matches dollar for dollar what you're getting out of the Confirmit license. Now, if you spend more, if you use more, then you're going to pay for it. But you're going to be cost neutral as long as you stay inside of your current contract parameters. But I want to be able to bid on that ad hoc work that was $500,000. Okay. So that's an example of how you can have a SaaS scenario and compete with an existing dollar and ultimately win that existing dollar. But you've got to have, in that example, you have to have a long view of the revenue.
And so, Jim, just to talk me through that. So would you be offering that alongside Confirmit for free? And you're going, you know, best supplier wins, use whatever you will, but I've taken away the immediate upfront switching cost. But is that the...
Yeah, you're addressing the switching. There's a nuanced difference here. One is, let's say that there was 6 months left on the Confirmit license. I'm going to sign up for 12 months plus 6 months. So in that case, it's an 18-month contract for the customer. Okay. So it isn't the case that best. I've already proven that I'm the best at that point. They're a believer. So that we've crossed that hurdle. The second part there is, and this is an important distinction, is oftentimes your contract is like minimum usage, meaning that there's a lot of upside opportunity inside of that existing contract on day one. So I'm framing the contract so I'm capturing the additive utilization that's above their contract norm.
Gotcha. I see. So, Jim, I warned you I might throw all the plan questions totally out of the window. And this is great because there's so much stuff I want to ask you. It does, I think, interrelate into one of the questions about what on earth does a chief revenue officer do? What does a CRO do? And how is that different from a head of sales?
Yeah, well, and to your point, like the nuances are specific to the organization. And to that end, titles are often cultural in nature inside of my observation, inside of organizations. So you might have organizations that are very C-suite heavy that are, $20 million or under, which is kind of silly in some ways because, you know, you think chief executives of like a 50 or 100 million or half a billion dollar business, right? Vox Popmia's framework, which is where I serve right now, is CRO. There's a chief product officer, a CTO, chief customer success manager. So there, and so in order to play in that playground at a peer level, you have to have a C title. And so the difference between a CRO at Vox Popmia and a vice president of sales or head of revenue or whatever in another company is none in terms of the actual like job function itself. Now, I will say that there has been a unification of marketing and sales inside of the business, meaning that instead of you having like a chief marketing officer and a chief revenue officer, you know, those sometimes can be separate job functions, this organization has opted to combine them into one job function. And so I oversee all of marketing and all of sales. And the benefit of that, of course, is that you have more of a focus on attribution, focused efforts that drive outcomes, as opposed to more branding initiatives or more abstract frameworks, which, you know, have their place. But, you know, if you're living and dying on a quarterly basis and on an annual basis, you're thinking a lot about like, if I put a dollar in, how am I getting $3 out?
And Jim, I've heard other people describe in the past the idea that marketing and sales are really the same thing, but that marketing is you as an organization to many, and sales is you as an organization to very few in terms of the people who may actually buy your product, your service. Would you agree with that?
I mean, I would say categorically, you know, marketing is a company's performance over time and how, you know, how relevant it is as the brand of choice for whatever you're offering. And then sales, I mean, these are quota-bearing individuals, meaning that, you know, they are definitely in the trenches, building relationship with customers, doing the gap analysis, understanding where the opportunities are, you know, and continuing that like flywheel of connecting with customers in a way that helps customers.
In basic terms, what does VoxPopMe do? And why did you join from HubUX?
I mean, so, you know, the story of HubUX was a four-year startup. Eric Santos and myself, he had worked with me at Decipher. He had left and started another platform in the B2B space, software platform, and then that sold, and he was looking for his next gig. So it just coincidentally worked out well. The impetus for HubUX was in 2018. I was doing a podcast interview on the Happy Market Research podcast with Estrella Lopez Brea. At the time, she was the head of insights for the Cereal Partnership, which is, I believe, General Mills and Nestle. It's a massive organization that you've never heard of. They sell Cheerios to 136 countries, you know, that kind of thing. Anyway, and she was telling me this story about how their CEO had institutionalized qualitative research. The CEO, along with all key executives that wanted to keep their jobs, every quarter they would visit customers and observe them eating breakfast, observe them consuming the products that they were selling. And, you know, these are real humans connecting with real humans. And it took a customer from the boardroom, which is represented in a pie chart. And that CEO would have this funny saying, nobody has 2.3 kids. And then it would reduce that conversation reduce that pie chart to actually a relationship on a one-to-one basis and humanize that customer in a way that really helped them make solid business decisions. The biggest problem that Estrella had at that point in time was the recruiting and coordination for those on-site interviews. It was difficult, right? I mean, you're talking 136 countries, things there. And these are high risk because you got the freaking CEO. You've got the head of sales. If you've done a bad job screening and they've flown.
That's not good. I hear you.
It's a bad outcome. And so I thought to myself, that should be a problem. Why is that hard? It's just logistics. And there's technology, et cetera, we should be able to create a solution for that. And so that was the impetus. Again, is there pain? Yes, there was pain. It was a lot of risk for the Cereal Partnership, recruiting people, scheduling people, making sure that they were who they said they were, all those kinds of things. Pain. And you know, did they recognize their pain? I mean, she's the one voicing it to me. So of course she did. Were they willing to pay for it? Actually, they were. I think she did on the podcast, but I can't remember specifically. But I mean, it was a very large number dollars that they were putting against trying to solve this problem on an annual basis. And would they buy it from me? That was the outstanding question. Well, I didn't have anything to sell at this point in time. So, you know, because it was in the inception. So that was really the impetus for saying, hey, I think there's a market opportunity of WX. And so we built the platform. It took us about a year to get it up and running and started scaling it. One of the challenges that we hit with COVID was that corporate budgets froze and their appetite for adding new providers or products was quite literally zero. It's very hard to sell into these organizations. And so that's when, at the time, Dave Carruthers, who's no longer with the business, but he was the CEO of VoxPopMe, And I started some conversations, early stage conversations about what does the business look like if it's combined. Vox Popme had at that point in time solely focused on asynchronous or video surveys, these like 5 to 8 question surveys that were video based, and they had the machine learning and AI in place to analyze that data. So in October of 2022, we announced the acquisition of HubUX. We supported the synchronous work, they support the asynchronous work, and they have a platform that allows us to analyze all the data in a single location, solving a really big problem. And so I say the overwrapping thesis for me is that I believe that qualitative research is going to grow much faster than quantitative research over the next 10 years. And the reason I believe that is at the end of the day, a survey is just trying to facilitate a conversation at scale. But nobody speaks in Likert scales. Nobody speaks like in pick lists. And so the ability to be able to analyze 1,000 people's points of view, have a conversation with 1,000 people via in a qualitative framework is very, very intriguing, very powerful, because it allows you to really uncover the true, connect with humans in a human way, which surveys frankly just don't do. And that for me is the big vision of what Vox Popme is bringing to the market from a market research benefit perspective.
Yeah, that is really interesting. I guess it speaks to this notion, the idea that traditional quantum qual has all become about the why, because the what is now available in all sorts of other data, which isn't to say, by the way, that I think that survey is dead. And I noticed that didn't say that it's going to go away. It still has.
It's going to grow. It's going to keep growing. But I will say that, like, you know, Rohair Verhulst, he's the head of insights for LinkedIn. I have a good relationship with him. A couple of years ago, he stopped doing A/B testing in surveys, and he literally just he doesn't do it himself, but he has one of his team members who will launch a A/B study launch an ad campaign on Facebook, and he'll see which ad wins, right, based on clicks, and he has his answer to the question. That whole process might just take hours, and has almost no cost to it, right? Quite literally dollars. And so, you know, we are seeing disruption in the survey space, but by no means are we, you know, going the way of the dinosaurs. I believe surveys are going to continue to grow, granted at a nominal rate. But I do think that the green field for us, and to your point, like, everybody's asking why. I just did the onboarding for Google's generative AI training, developer training. And in the onboarding, I believe it was the CPO, I mean, the CTO, whatever, you know, whoever it was, but a big deal. Said it's never been more important for companies to be able to understand the customer's why. And it's because it's about building human stories, connecting with real people. And I think that's what's so interesting about generative AI, thinking about like your utilization of ChatGPT. Yesterday I did some closed loss analysis on Vox Popme's on my pipeline. And so I entered in all the reasons that rep said that we lost an opportunity, whatever number it was. And I said, please summarize, you know, this data in 5 categories. And it did. And then it provided, you know, percentages and things like that. And so, you know, you're able to interact with unstructured data and then have very meaningful, actionable outcomes from that for the first time. Like, this never happened, right, for us mm-hmm. before. And the biggest point of waste, by the way, in market research is still open-ended unstructured text. So, like, there's such a rich opportunity for us to be able to leverage this using generative AI.
Yeah, actually, that, again, is a really good point, I think, in that, as you say, surveys have been, I think, inhibited by quite a rigid structure. You know, the best way of getting information out of people is usually to have a conversation, and it tends to be fluid, you know, in the way in which this conversation is. But I suppose there has been that inhibiting factor whereby, you know, doing hundreds of you wouldn't do hundreds of focus groups. That way, I've just proven the point. You might do tens of focus groups if it's a big kind of project. And part of that, I guess, just has been the time to process it and all that can be done relatively easily now.
I just did a project for Microsoft. We did N equals 600. Okay. This was a video survey. 300 were in Brazil and 300 were in North America North America. And so, I can't remember the exact number. It was, I believe, 8 video questions along with some other diagnostic questions, traditional survey questions. And what we were able to get out of it wasn't just answers to their questions, but we're able to uncover hidden gems around things like brand love and key moments, you know, things that you would just never be able to pull out of quantitative data, but you would hope to get from qualitative data, but you're able to get that qualitative insight at scale. And Steve Jobs has this quote, which I'm sure I'm going to botch, but it goes something like, the most dangerous person in the room is the one who can tell a good story. And his intent there is really to illustrate how if you can connect to your audience through story, you're going to have something that is then repeatable by your audience. And so now you have this like story is leverageable in an organization, whereas pie charts just aren't. If you can communicate something that resonates through the eyes of the consumer, it's like your stakeholders will be go, oh my gosh, there's that human truth. And that'll help them connect with the data and then actually create change.
Yeah, totally agreed. And actually quite a few of the interviewees on this podcast have made similar points just from different angles.
So now we're totally off into, in my opinion, the most important topic that researchers can take away from today's conversation. And that it isn't about the data. Your consumer, the people that are the executives that are taking your information and then making decisions. What they're really looking for is the one thing that they can take away from it and then apply to the business, like the action that goes against it. We've talked about insights to action at nauseam, right? Over the last 20 years, this is obviously very important. That's not lost on people. But what is lost on people is the lever. And the lever of change is the degree of the quality of the story that you tell. And that story, this is the part everybody hates. That story needs to be repeatable. If it isn't repeatable, you've done a bad job. If a day later, somebody intercepts one of your audience members at the water cooler, the virtual water cooler, is that person, you know, your audience member going to be able to retell the point of view that you had?
Yeah, I very much agree. I mean, all those years of doing movie research, I think it's a very good example of that in that, you know, you can conceptually have an idea and a film studio may have three or four ideas about how they want to market a movie. But until you go through the process of trying it out and winnowing it down and testing out exactly those types of things. Can people tell me what this movie is about and why I'd go and see it? No, none of it really counts. You know, you can have, right. You can have a very nuanced picture that, again, people just, as you say, they struggle to repeat. And
it's exactly 35% of males, right, think X. That isn't telling a story that is repeatable. I did a study this past April with BET. This is public knowledge. One of their major advertisers is a CPG whose name I can't disclose. But in that CPG, they had us do 50 ethnographies. And so part of the ethnography was understanding how people store their or decide to purchase and ultimately store their cleaning supplies. And so in the ethnography, we actually had them go show us where they store their cleaning supplies. And the interesting part of that, right, was the person's telling you about their purchase behaviors, and then they flip their camera, and now you're walking around their house with them. And then you go to their where they're storing their cleaning supplies. Like the space between the cleaning supplies and the house that you're exposed to is what was super interesting about the key findings. Okay. And that's the part of the story that oftentimes we lose in quant research, right? We get right to the data, but we don't have the context for their points of view. We lose that. And we try to address it with more questions, but you and I both know that just doesn't work. So that's where I think, you know, the next 10 years, qualitative research is going to be very interesting.
Now, Jim, if it's okay, I wanted to jump off the market research space for a moment. Yeah. And just touch on some of the charitable endeavors that you're involved in. There are a host of them, and be good to just touch on some of those, maybe kind of call them out so people can support them and understand what you and they are looking to achieve.
I'm a big believer in investing in where you live. We need diversity inside of market research. We need it everywhere, categorically. And there's oftentimes the case that lower income, like if you're successful, you wind up moving to a coastal city. And the problem is that you stop investing subsequently into the communities that you're part of. And so a big part of my ethos and my wife's as well is make a difference, you know, grow where you're planted, make a difference where you live. And for me, the way that I try to accomplish that, which is a little bit self-serving, by the way, is by job creation. And then the second way is investment with time and energy with the Boys and Girls Club of America. That's another one that's a really near and dear to me. There are in my community, 8 out of 10, which is how the statistic is recited, of children that are under the age of 18 are disadvantaged, and half of them have empty refrigerators. So when you think about like our opportunities to help solve this some generational issues, it is, in my opinion, a lot about like job creation and then also mentorship and connection. And so for me, you know, where my time is spent outside of work and family and fun also, by the way, is set to try to solve some of these bigger issues.
So, Jamin, whereabouts do you live in the U.S.? I should probably know this already.
Yeah, place called Central Valley of California, Fresno, California. It's right in the heart, largely agricultural in nature. So we have a lot of first and second generation Americans here, just given the nature of, you know, farm labor by default. I happen to be fourth generation and from this area. Yeah, my opening slide, I've never done this for market research, maybe I will someday because I just don't think anybody cares. But my first slide, I also teach at a local, I teach some MBA courses at Fresno State. And my opening slide on the Get to Know You is a picture of me at 11 years old picking grapes, because that was literally how I was. It was grapes for raisins, is how I was, you know, we were making money for the family. My sister and I both did this growing up. So, you know, very much a blue collar background.
Credit to you in, you know, giving back your time and commercial support to the local area. It's just I had maybe this misguided perception that lots of people do, you know, California's whatever it is, if it was
fancy
independent country, seventh biggest economy and all that type of thing.
Yeah.
It just made me very naive of me. I had no idea around the extent of the poverty on a wide scale nature within California.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Fresno, the Central Valley Fresno is the sixth largest city in California. And it's also one of the most disadvantaged zip codes or DMAs in America. So it's a interesting dichotomy, tale of two cities living here.
I want to know a little bit about Parsec Education, which you're also involved with. So what's going on there?
Parsec Education, this is an ed tech company, educational technology company. It's in the startup phase, and I've never seen a company grow as fast as this company has grown. It is scratching. So, you know, one of the challenges in, if you're a teacher, and my wife, by the way, in full disclosure, is a fifth grade, school teacher. One of the challenges is crafting educational plans for, students that map to what's called the standards. So what is the competency or the, you know, what, you know, level of math does a student need to have, what, you know, reading, writing, all the things, right? And so that's very challenging at a classroom level because you have to deal with it at an individual level. So if you have, let's say, 35 children in a classroom, and you can imagine the disparity between some overperformers and underperformers. Now, as a kid, you're kind of immune to all this because you're so like myopic and focused on yourself. But as a teacher, this is a big problem. Because you have some kids that, you know, can't read. Like that's literally a thing that she has to deal with, which is unfortunate in fifth graders. And you also can't cater to the least common denominator because nobody's gonna estimate. And so one of the things that Parsec does that I'm super in tune with is it understands the requirements that are set up by the California School Board and at the classroom level. And then it assesses the student based on their test scores. And then it creates a customized plan for each student that the teacher can then employ to help that student understand or to gain traction and ultimately get up to the school board standards.
And then how is the plan delivered?
Yeah. That's probably more of a question from like my practitioner, like my wife, but But from what she tells me every night, the way that it's ultimately, because to your point, like you're in a finite, you're in a, like a tight tight classroom, and you're not sitting there one-on-one with the students. Thankfully, technology now, I mean, COVID was catastrophic, but one of the things that came out of it was technology adoption and proficiency, both with students, but more importantly with teachers. So there is work that is done on Chromebooks. The benefit is it does help because the teacher doesn't have the burden of having to come up with 35 individualized plans. They're able to start with an existing template.
Jim, I'm conscious of time, so I might start to wrap up, but do a few final questions. And I'm going to throw one at you that you actually just mentioned. What do you do for fun? I mean, you're busy, you're creating successful companies, you're helping the local economy. So you must have some fun sometimes.
I have a lot. I have probably more fun than I should. I have two things that I love to do. One is I still play this video game called Eve Online. I don't play it a lot. I play it for maybe 30 minutes a day. Sometimes, you know, if I get online with my friends, I have some friends we connect through Discord that play it as well. You know, we might be out for like 3 or 4 hours if my wife will allow me to a couple times a month. But so that's like thing one. And thing two is woodworking. I'm very passionate about woodworking. I hope that my last business that I do is a carpentry business for custom furniture. That's my, you know, 10 years from now, you know, I got a lot of skill I need to catch up on, but yeah, that's my long game.
So do you have kids? I'm not sure if you have
five.
Kids, I mean. You have five kids. That's all.
Yeah. Oldest is 21. The youngest is 6. And so like, I was just talking, my wife and I start our day every morning talking about the three things that we're thankful for. And this morning, which is November 14th, 2023, I told her one of the things I was thankful for is the bedtime ritual. I sit down on the couch with the kids. They climb on top of me. We watch Bluey, which is this fantastic cartoon. And then they both jump on my back and I carry them to their bedroom. And my wife is a monster chasing us, which ultimately winds up with me getting elbowed in the eye or some like... Yeah, nothing. But it's like those are the moments that I think all of us live for and need in life. And so, you know, if we have those things and basic necessities, of course, then everything's going to be okay.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds fantastic. I'm assuming these are the two youngest kids, by the way.
Yeah, the 21-year-old. I'd be on his shoulder. He's 6'1". He's a big dude.
Yeah. And actually, on that subject, so... what personal traits of yours would you like your children to inherit? But perhaps even more pertinently, are there any they should avoid?
Well, I'm not sure I'd be willing to share the avoid, but I will share it is funny, isn't it? Our greatest strengths are oftentimes our greatest weaknesses. I'm a grinder. I love what I do. I work, of course, but I also am very passionate about my work. Like literally, I'm excited about getting back to some Excel sheets that I'm going to be working on after this call. So I think the things that I would hope that my children would adopt is this ability to be able to really focus for long periods of time on the same thing. And then also the discipline of showing up despite how you feel, despite how you're, you know, and I've taken that definitely to an extreme. Right in 2021, I wound up with an infection in my face, and I had this really bad swelling, but I was scheduled to speak at a conference in Washington, D.C. And so instead of like not doing it, I literally put on a COVID mask so you couldn't see this like really disturbing swelling that was in my face. And I went and did the event. So that's an example of, I think maybe I take it a little too far of honoring those commitments, but it's served me well enough.
So I will take that as, you know, sometimes you can take it too far as maybe the trait where you would
exactly
suggest, you know, a little bit of moderation, self-awareness from that.
Right. Yeah. Which I definitely lack. I'm not going to let go of the bone.
Jemin, thank you so much. As always, it's a pleasure talking to you and incredibly enlightening. And hopefully I can continue to pick your brain on all sorts of subjects.
Thank you so much for the opportunity, Henry. I really appreciate it.
Now, I don't know about you, but I learned a ton from Jemin. Amongst many others, I think he has a really key point around the importance of human data and how we make decisions in the future. That's also a key theme of the next interview in our series with one of the most senior and accomplished women in the insight sector, Tina Wilson, Group General Manager of Nielsen's portfolio of analytics businesses. Thank you once more to Insights Platforms for their support, to Brighter for sponsoring this episode, and to you for listening. See you next time.